Yeah. I never knew that you couldn't be able to really pause a stream with Prism. It turns out you actually can, and that's where you have to find a source like Prism or some kind of open broadcasting system that's able to take in that exact stream key in order to keep the stream alive, because that's essentially what you're using to keep the stream alive. So, yeah. There's other stuff that I actually need to do with the app. I just recently had the chat set up to receive only for quota reasons, which here's what one of my guys in Florida even told me. For unverified apps that are tied into Google's API, it's kind of complicated to explain it. You gotta, like, put in this address and this domain and this and that, and then you gotta, like, constantly keep releasing the app over and over until it signs you in successfully, because essentially you're telling the app to take control of your whole YouTube account, manage, modify, delete, edit, do whatever, mainly your streams besides your videos, and then it's wired into YouTube's RTMP being able to read the live chat. Now, what I want to do, if you send the app to Google, I think you need to put in, like, a privacy policy, and they got to see how you use the app and that you're not going to, like, abuse the quota in any ways. Quota, think of it like data, where whenever you send a live chat message or your stream is transitioning to live, that burns units. You get 10,000 units a day. It resets at midnight Pacific time. If you send the app to Google and they verify, it can upgrade your quota. You might have to pay a little bit for it, but one of my guys has a limit of 500,000.
Well, that should certainly be more than enough. I would assume that there's some non-zero risk of having your account hijacked under some circumstances.
Yeah, building custom apps has its cons. Like, when I try to build it locally on the machine using command prompts, it says there's, like, vulnerabilities. Figure that out later. But if anybody really wants to get a hold of this app, it's not locked specifically to my account. Anybody could log in and use it for their account if they wanted to, but there's a catch. I have a password coded in. Good luck.
Well, you'd be surprised how nimble some hackers are.
But it's not released to the App Store right now. It's just for me. You'd have to know the link itself, so really it's unlisted. I could set it up to only detect a very specific user. I don't really need to go through the hassle of that. But really, I think the app is in good hands, and given that I'm the only developer, I don't really have much of an issue to worry about that.
Okay, but, you know, we live in a dangerous time as far as the Internet is concerned. That, if anyone actually has the ability to see third parties, servers kind of banging away at private ports, the people, their computers are hooked up to the Internet, it looks ridiculous. It looks like a never-ending attack. I set up audio streams for Limark and also my other club, the Kings County Radio Club. And for some odd reason, the Kings County Radio Club's IceCast server has a Russian bot that likes to sit on there a couple of hours a week. I don't exactly know what it's doing, not much as far as I can figure. But, you know, it's kind of weird that there's a Russian bot that's just sitting there.
Yeah, but I can always fix those vulnerabilities later on, so I'm just trying to work on my app one piece at a time. I could actually talk about a very specific bug, if you probably might know, as far as technical nature. Take the mute button, for example. The mute button is very important on streaming apps. let's say you're having a topic with somebody and your topics are not necessarily extreme public or very sensitive or personal, you want to be able to hit that mute button because you never know who could be watching the stream. Viewers are one thing, but even if you're looking at the chat, you don't know who's really watching until you look at the chat. So when I hit the mute button, it does mute, but if you turn the volume up fully on a computer or even on the phone and you listen hard enough, there's like very faint static audio. It's like a buzzing effect. It's like, it's like very hard to hear, but it's still there. It sounds like it's muted, but it's like chunks of audio when it should be complete silence. I mean, it sounds muted, but you can hear like faint chunky effects. What should that usually be caused by?
Sounds like it's just bleed through from one channel to another.
Because Replit's trying to see if it might have to do with... It has nothing to do with the native audio because it's a little different. It's really the server side that you need to look at that might be the issue because there might be some bleed throughs, like you say, but it's using certain packets and it interprets it as like chunks of very faint audio when it should be like as if you were setting the volume to zero.
Well, but if it was really setting it to zero, there would be zero dB gain on it, and it wouldn't be reproducible. So something is getting through either the primary channel or a secondary channel that's not completely secured and locked down.
Yeah, I mean, it's not causing a problem now, so maybe I might just leave it alone. Here's the first thing that I had a problem with when the whole thing was WebView formatted and not native view, and that's what blocked out my flashlight. If I start the stream and the microphone is already muted before starting the stream, it should add and start the stream muted, but instead it started it with live audio. So now it's fixed where if I have muted before I start the stream and I go live, it's muted upon going live until I unmute it. The same thing, actually, with my onboard sequencer. If I need to do, like, less than 1 minute BRBs, which don't involve OBS, it's just an overlay of a full-screen picture that just sends it right back, and I even have it programmed to mute and dim the microphone so I don't have to manually do it every time. I just select an onboard scene, it overlays, I don't have to pause the stream, and the mic mutes with it.
Okay, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, that's the beauty with using AI, is you can tell it what code, and it literally does it. With Streamlabs, if you're selecting a scene, then once it displays, you have to manually mute the mic. It won't do it by itself. But with this custom app, I told it, overlay the scene, and mute the mic along with it.
Sorry, I got thrown off a ball star.
Whoops. I keep too early. That can happen. So yeah, with Streamlabs, you have to manually mute the mic. Versus custom apps, you can tell it, display the onboard scene, and mute the mic with it, so you don't have to physically do it every time. I also have an icon lock feature. Let's say I'm someplace dark, like on a ride, and I don't want to accidentally touch the flashlight, like if I need to click on some indicators, I can lock it, so that way it dims, and it doesn't become clickable. That's done through the settings.
Okay, well, you gotta expect that legitimate software has less controls open to the outside. So, you know, Streamlab or OBS has certain things that it's programmed to let you do, and most of the other things are hidden behind the application itself versus, you know, AI just, you know, has all the controls open to manipulate at your will.
Yeah, when I go to the next version, once I test out the photo thing, I actually got to republish and rebuild it, actually, now that I just saw the results. The orientation is correct, but it looks like it's zoomed in, so it's actually using a different format, and I need to wrap up this topic because nature is calling me very badly. What I want to implement, but I'm a little nervous about it because it worked for maybe a second and then it was just not working, are the telephoto lenses, where it's got like the 3X and then the 5X super zoom all the way out to 20. It doesn't really look different than the normal camera, but at least I have normal and ultra-wide working. What I'm actually going to do between all the lenses is I want to have the screen go black for half a second in between switches rather than snapping to each one. It looks a little more professional and maybe less of a nuisance. I actually want to implement that in there as well. So, yeah, my app's coming along very well and still stuff I got to work on with it. And I think it's time I pass this back to you. AC2GS and Control, KD2OGB.
Okay, Gulf, very good. Glad you popped in. It's been a long time since we chatted. I wish you good luck with your application, and come back when you have a chance.
Pleasure. Good night.
Good night, Craig. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and it's already past 10:13. I doubt if I'm going to find someone at this point to fill, 2 minutes and such. So I'll give anyone a chance. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments that they want to make before we move on to the next segment, please feel free. Okay, I suspected as much. Well, thank you all for participating, those who did. And please join me again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do this all over again. But it seems like a great time to turn it over to WS2N, Paul, with the SpaceNet Report.
Pretty good, WS2N. And, I haven't heard of Craig on in a while. But very good. I know all about how to make an app. Good topic. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And we're going to cover just a few topics tonight. Of course, the main topic is the one that's news all week, which is the Artemis 2 mission that launched on April 1st, and it's way to the moon. And as far as where it's actually going to go past the moon, looking forward to that. You know, a day and a half after raising its altitude going around the Earth, they wanted to check everything, make sure everything was okay, and if it wasn't, they would be able to easily bring them back to Earth. But as time went on, they said, okay, let's get to a higher altitude, and they went from low altitude all the way up to 40,000 miles up. That's like almost twice the height of the geosynchronous satellites are, and then they would come all the way back and go right near the Earth by around a couple of hundred for perigee and then back up to apogee. That kind of an orbit actually took over a day to complete. So that's why it took a day and a half. It was really only two orbits around the Earth. And then they declared that everything was good to go, and they got the okay to go to go through TLR, lunar injection, which they did. With that, they fire the what that is, just one engine, 6,000 pounds of thrust. It's actually an old shuttle engine. Shuttle used to have these engines called OMS, Orbital Maneuvering System. There are two of them, look this back. There were big, gigantic engines. That was for getting into orbit. But then there was two of them, one on the port side, one on the starboard side, attached to the shuttle itself. And they took one of those, gave it over to European Space Agency, and they installed it into service module. European Space Agency is responsible for building the service module, and Lockheed Martin is involved with the Orion spacecraft itself. And they put them both together, so it's an project. Canada, of course, is involved with it, and that's why you have one of the crew members is actually from Canada. So this international project is well underway. They fired that engine for about almost a minute, and I pushed them from 17,500 miles an hour up to 25,000 miles an hour. Started heading away from the Earth and in the direction of the Moon. And that's been going on now for, I guess, a couple of days now. It's usually around a 3 to 4 day trip once you go through TLI into before you get into lunar orbit. So right now they've slowed down from that 25,000 miles per hour. They've slowed down to like around 4,000 miles an hour. So, yeah, Earth is constantly trying to slow them down, pulling the spacecraft back. But because they went through escape velocity, they're not coming back. So off they go, and then now to the point of getting pulled in by the moon. They call it the moon's sphere of influence. So that 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour will slowly increase to a little over 6,000 miles an hour as it gets near the moon. They're not going to orbit the moon, they're just going to pass in front of it. And they'll continue on beyond the moon, roughly around 4,000 miles per hour. And as they're going there, they're going to be slowing down little by little. They'll be out of radio contact for almost an hour, about 45 minutes, as they're behind the moon in relationship to us. Eventually, they'll get pulled back on the opposite side of the moon, and then just keep on going right back to Earth. So no fuel is really necessary. From TLI, which they did a day and a half ago, to for forever. They could go all the way to the moon and all the way back without any fuel. As long as everything was just accurate, maybe they could do a couple of fine thrusts if they needed different thrusters on board the spacecraft to do that, if they want to change direction or if they want to turn around, which they will do. When they get past the moon, they are going to turn around and face the moon so they can see good view of the moon as they're behind it. They see the moon is because, the news media, I listen to it all the time, and I keep saying the dark side of the moon, at 14 days during the month, it's the dark side of the moon, but the other 14 days, it's light. And they chose this window of opportunity because it will be light on that side. So you'll have the sun behind them, then in between that you have the spacecraft, and then you have the moon. And then keep going in line, you'll have the Earth. So that's why we'll be out of contact with the but at the same time, they'll be able to see quite clearly the surface of the moon on the far side of the moon. Yeah, we have pictures, close-up pictures and everything of the far side, because we've had spacecraft going around there for years. The LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, has been up there since 2009, no problem. But, you know, the stuff, seeing it for yourself, you're going to get some great pictures through the year, through the windows. The four crewmen three of them are experienced flyers. The other one from Canada is not first time for him. Interesting thing, I find is that three of them are ham radio operators. They all have their tickets, except for Christina Cook, Gober, and the pilot and the commander all have their license.
There is no dark side of the moon, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark. KC2, SHO.
Hi, John. Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, it's dark for 14 days, right? And then it's light for 14 days. And, yeah, that's true. And what we're looking at, the moon, you know, you go out now to look at the moon, you know, the moon is really starting to get dark. You know, it's heading to the new moon phase. So it's a good opportunity to do what they're doing. And they'll get pictures, and I'm sure it'll help them make some decisions on future landing missions. You know, they do want to land there. Side of the moon. How are you doing, John?
Yeah, real good. Oh, it's, I was hoping it was more recognizable. That's a quote from the Pink Floyd album, The Dark Side of the Moon. When they were interviewing some of the people who worked around the studio, one of them said, there is no dark side of the moon. Matter of fact, it's all dark. And what's probably a little misunderstood is how dark the surface of the moon is. They say the surface of the moon is as dark as asphalt. And if it was any other brighter color, it sure would change the way nights appear.
True. Hi, Paul. One of the missions, the landing missions that Apollo did, one of the astronauts did find something that was green. A little happy about that. They had that on tape.
Hi, Paul.
Some of the... Exactly this. You know, Apollo 8, for instance. But, you know, you have... Borman and Lowell and Anders, you know, that were on Apollo 8. Unfortunately, they are all gone. In fact, all the astronauts that have flown to the moon, either stayed on the command module or actually went down to the surface, all are gone except for two. I remember going through this not too long ago. And, I think it was Duke, and Scott. They were on different missions. One was on 15, the other one was on 16. I'm not sure which one was which. But they're still around, but they're in their 90s. But still, it would be great to interview them. You know, they're the only ones left that actually have flown to the moon and back. So, yeah. Anyway, this should be interesting tomorrow. Of course, that will be the main news, hopefully. For some reason, they decided to name the Spacecraft Integrity, who picked that name. So they're calling it Integrity. If you hear them making those calls, you know, they're using that name.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Ah,
so it got off. Okay, good show, good show. So, aside from the toilet problems, which could be a little nasty, I hope everything goes well.
You know, that's considered a no-go. If that thing was not working before TLI, you know, that's definitely on the list as a no-go. They fixed it once, and I believe they need to fix it again. And Christina Cook is the one that really gets herself involved with that project. She's out of the group. She's got some kind of degrees in mechanical engineering and all. She fixed a whole bunch of stuff when she was on the International Space Station for almost a year. I don't think it's going to be a problem. And there's always Plan B.
You know, aside from the toilet issue,
all
going pretty well.
They've made a lot of major changes in the last couple of weeks.
Celestial mechanics is involved, where they have to go ahead and speed up and then slow down, not maintain a more constant speed.
The idea was to dock with the space station, you know, on Artemis 3, and then they were supposed to have one of the two and the scrap. And they could hang out on the space station for a while, get themselves together, and then, you know, when they're ready, they could fire their rockets, come back to Earth. Now that whole system is out the window, which I disagree with. But part of it, I do agree with. They're going to take the Artemis 3 mission instead of going to the moon and landing on the moon. They're going to use that to verify the docking procedures with either one or both of the docking vehicles. One docking vehicle is by Blue Origin, and that's called the Blue Moon. The Blue Moon landed. It could land up to four people on the surface. But, you know, that will be the one that they will probably use unless by Elon Musk with SpaceX. That thing's under development. But then again, that's way behind schedule. Their plans are to take this Artemis 3 that was planned on the moon and Earth orbit and have them one or both of these vehicles. You know, if both of them, they could have them both in orbit. They could fly over to one dock with it, have a Orion and return, and then it's ready. They could do this, which is duplicating what they did with Apollo 9. You know, Apollo 7 checked out that command module in Earth orbit, make sure it was okay. Artemis skipped that step. They're sending the first crew. Yeah. we'll see. This should happen next year. If that goes well, then they plan on having Artemis 4 and 5 actually be the ones that land on the moon. One interesting thing I noticed that, you know, you could bring up the live feed from NASA. On the very upside of these solar panels, you know, they have solar panels that are developing up to 6,000 kilowatts of power. There's 40 solar panels that open up. By the way, this whole design with solar panels and the service module and everything was really designed from the European Space Agency cargo vehicle that used to go up to the space station around once a year and dock with the space station called the ATV. So well that they decided to use that model for the service module for Artemis. And if you look at the old ATV pictures, you know, of their vehicle docking with the International Space Station, you see this massive solar panel sticking out. And that's what they used on Artemis. The Apollo missions didn't have any solar panels. They ran on fuel cells. You know, you need power, and this was a real good way to go. Years ago, in those days, solar panels were very heavy, difficult, and didn't put out as much power per square foot like these things do. So they're using a solar panel for power. Interesting thing about what I'm saying was, at the very end of these long solar panels, they have cameras that are looking at the spacecraft, and which makes for a great picture. But if you notice, the sun and the shadow of anything that you're looking at is pretty much staying in one spot. You know, maybe if you come back, 20 minutes later, you see it might have moved a little bit. That means the spacecraft is not rolling. What I mean by rolling is the Apollo, all the way up, the Apollos, when they went to the moon, they would rotate. And they would rotate like roughly around two or three revolutions per minute. So, you know, they'd roll. And the reason for it is, you know, you have sun, and the sun would be like cooking one end of the spaceship all the time. So you'd be getting 250-degree temperatures touching the side of the spacecraft. And the other side was ice cold. So to distribute that heat evenly, it was called a barbecue maneuver. It was something or other maneuver, but for short, they called it the barbecue, like a barbecue spit. So it would just rotate. You'll notice on Artemis, they don't do that. You know, modern technology, things have changed. They use an active cooling system. They have a fluid, like an ethylene type of fluid that's in these tanks. And it's pumped through a series of tubes on the outside of the spacecraft. So it's an active cooling system. Now, it's not like a refrigerant system. They don't have a high side and a low side. But what they have is this fluid is, goes near the wall of the spacecraft, picks up the heat, and then they have pumps inside, and the fluid is pumped to these radiators. And the radiators actually emit the heat from that they're picking up on the walls of the spacecraft, through this active cooling piping system. So I think that's pretty interesting. And, things have changed in the last 50-some-odd years, whatever it was since Apollo 17. Any comments?
Well, it's very interesting what you just said, and you know, certainly we'll see how it all pans out. I'm sure there'll be refinements to a lot of those systems after this is complete, especially with the toilet. I just wonder whether it's best to have three people and more space and maybe two toilets rather than four people and one toilet.
You need the four people because their plan is to, in the early landing time, and then the other two will stay in the spacecraft. And, the craft. When you to the surface on LM, and they have one person taking care of the command module. So, and then long term plans are someday to actually be able to take all four people, like I mentioned before. Blue Origin has the Blue Moon lander, which has the capability of sending four people down to the surface at a time. So, I mean, they have plans that you could actually leave the command module in orbit, you know, all by itself. So that means they need to know that they could comfortably fit four people in this cramped space. For you know, up to in this case, has the capability of staying in the one on the surface for a long period of time, and there happens to be a little bit of a problem. There could be an amount. Not having the space station in orbit. A mother. The International Gateway Station would have. It's a bad move, especially when it was, they had hardware ready to go. The habitat module and the PE element together, and they were going to fly together on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy, which is a reliable rocket. And, and not too distant. The end of this year, putting this thing into orbit around the moon, having it wait for a crew, but it's all out the window. I still say it's a bad move. Let me drop it. So, we're also going to change the orbit. That's the thing they plan on doing. They're going to go into something called an elliptical polar orbit with coplanar line. It's called CPO / COLA. The idea is to go away from the planned system of using a near rectilinear halo orbit. Now, the difference between a near rectilinear halo orbit, which is where the Gateway space station was in orbit, is that was planned on orbiting the moon around 40,000 miles away, which is a little far. But then when it came back to around 1,000 miles above the surface of the moon, and then it was highly elliptical. That was the plan for that. And the reason for that is that that orbit was chosen because they planned on using this Orion spacecraft the way it is, with the service engine that they're using, with the power that they have right now, which is what they plan on having for 3, 4, 5 into the future. That's all the power they were going to use. It's enough to get into this highly elliptical orbit. It's not enough power to go into a 60-mile high or 62-mile high orbit like the Apollo missions did. Apollo was circular, but close to the planet, 62 miles. It takes a lot of power, a lot of delta to convert from this extremely high elliptical near halo rectilinear to a circular orbit. The Orion does not have the capability of doing that. So they were going to go into that orbit, and then eventually dock with the lunar lander, and lunar lander would have went down there. Could have spent, a week or two down there. It wouldn't matter. They didn't have a space station up there. Somebody would have been on the space station. One or two crew members that stayed on Orion could stay up there if they like. They wouldn't feel pressured if there was an emergency. But now, with all that they're talking about, this elliptical polar orbit with a line of this thing is what it's elliptical. The vehicle to its limits to get into it because it's a smaller orbit. It's not 60 miles, but it goes around 60 miles to a high inclination, maybe 4,000 miles away. And to make that orbit, it would take roughly nine hours. The near halo rectilinear orbit would take 6 days, 6 days to orbit. This orbit would take 9 hours. So it's not too bad, unless there's a real emergency. What you really want to be is in a circular orbit, 62 miles high, which they won't be able to. But they orbit the moon every hour. So, you get a crew off the surface in a real hurry if there was a problem. 9 hours, 9 or 10 hours, I think that's kind of long. But, doable. And that's what they plan on doing. The other one with a 40,000-mile highly elliptical orbit takes 6 days. It sounds terrible. Oh, if there's an emergency, what do you do? Yeah, but if there's an emergency, you could hang out on the space station. The space station, could stay there for days, on end. There won't be a rush. So I think that could be a problem. Any comments?
Oh, good background. Good background. Kind of interesting, actually. Do they intend to have the space station dock the Artemis 3 and land?
CW go by. I love CW. The number 3 is going to be, which is the next one, put into Earth orbit only. And they plan on docking with the future lunar landers. They want to have both of them, hopefully, in Earth orbit and just dock with them, see how it all works out. If it all works out, they could sit back. Another thing they want to do on that flight is they want to test out the actual EVA spacesuits that they will be on the surface of the moon, built by Axiom. So then another thing that they'll be doing on 3. And once that's okay, they'll just deorbit, come back and land in the Pacific Ocean again. Number 4 would be now, the next one. See, the original plan was to have 3 be the lander. That was going to, you know, go out to the moon. But now, so 3 is just going to be Earth orbit. Then 4 is going to be, they plan on actually landing people on the moon, and so will 5. And they plan on doing 4 and 5 all within 1 year. I mean, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I would have bet on that. But, I mean, that is now the plan, Brian.
So, if all goes according to plan, when is Artemis 3 slated to launch?
That was launched into orbit unless one or two of those vehicles, landing vehicles, see, they're competing against each other. Originally, they gave the contract to SpaceX, build us a Starship that's going to land on the moon. And they said, wait a minute. NASA, you're always into redundancy. So time went by and a lot of push and pull and who knows what kind of policy. Anyway. Kinetics and Blue Origin that been on, they got the contract. So one of those two have to be in orbit. They actually said if both aren't ready, as long as one is ready, I mean, if and maybe, they're really, I'm going to be, you know, sound like either a broken record in the future, or I'm going to be making a lot of changes. Either one or the two. Back to you, Brian.
I would just like to see them land at least, and then worry about the testing with the docking with the other units that could be done in orbit. At least to try that. So when do you, I'm sorry, maybe I missed it. When do you expect Artemis 3 to launch?
Yeah, I didn't say that. 27 next year, sometime next year. I don't know what month. But yeah, you bring up a good point. Yeah, that's part of the plan, just what you said. Forget about, for now, Artemis 3 docking with the two vehicles. Above and beyond that, yes, they want SpaceX and Blue Origin to send their landing vehicles all the way out to the moon all by themselves with no people, and they would like to see them land on the moon and make sure they work autonomously without a crew. But yeah, that, as far as I know, is still a plan. But, you know, you're right about that.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens. And looking for some nice photographs of the moon. And like to see them land on it already.
Yeah, that's what's cool. What's good about this net anyway? We can put it some weeks. One other mission that just went up, by the way, I don't want to forget, is Amazon. They wanted to put up another 29 broadband satellites to add to their collection up there. They had just over 200 now. I think they have 239. In orbit for their broadband satellites. They used to call it the Kuiper satellites. They changed the name to LEO satellites, LEO. But they just launched one today, yesterday morning at 1 o'clock in the morning. the thing went up on an Atlas V. It was the heaviest amount of weight that the Atlas V has ever lifted so far. It used to be, they used to be able to take up 27. Not able to add two more, so they added, 29 broadband satellites went up yesterday morning, and their goal is to, their goal was to actually have, I think, 1,500 within the next couple of months, I think by the end of July. They're not going to make that, so Blue Origin is putting a request in to the government. See, they made a contract with the government when they did this years ago. He decided to pour $10 billion into this broadband satellite system to compete against Starlink. And the government at the time said, yeah, you can do that. And what frequencies do you want? Oh, I want this frequency. I want this band and that band. And, well, okay, well, we'll give it to you. You'll be able to use it. But the deal is you have to, make sure you're operational by a certain time. We can't just let you warehouse these frequencies. Any Tom, Dick, and Harry, rocket company can come along and say, okay, I'm going to put a constellation of communication satellites in orbit, let me have these frequencies, and if there's no timeline on it, now I got the rights for these frequencies forever, whether I put anything up into space or not. So the government, they made a contract with them, and now they're not going to be able to meet up with that contract. So what's going to happen, in the near future? Is Jeff Bezos going to get, an extension? Where are they going to say, oh, no, that's it, you cut off, or worse than that, you could do it again, but you're going to need new frequencies. Let's see, what frequencies can we use? Bands are out there, you don't want them pointing to the amateur bands or anybody else. Back to you, Brian.
Oh, good to know. Do you know that Taco Bell is launching a spacecraft into low Earth orbit, and it's being powered by refried beans? That's right, refried beans. The name of the spacecraft is called Fartimus.
Very good. Yeah. I have to remember that one very well. Very well done. Yeah. Those beans will give you plenty of get up and go, I guess. Anyway, there's another mission. New Glenn is they plan on going on the 10th of this week, which is this week. But I don't see anything in the news to reconfirm that. But they plan on putting up another one of their heavy, gigantic rockets. Yeah, New Glenn, they've launched them, launched this thing twice so far, and they're reusable. Well, the first stages, anyway. And the last flight that they went on, the second one, they landed perfectly dead center of the drone ship that they had out there. And now, it's been refurbished. They plan on launching it again. And they plan on putting a bunch of some kind of I think it's communication satellites up there for a company called Bluebird. So that's a problem again, which is important because that's the rocket. The New Glenn is the rocket that will launch the lander not only to the moon but next year into Earth orbit. Dock with Artemis 3. So that thing has to be, really up and running. But, if it's anything like the last flight, it was perfect. It should be good. See, they've got a usable rocket they've actually put into orbit twice. I mean, the plan goes the way it is, you know, maybe this week or so, they'll do it again. That's their heavy lift vehicle that they'll use for sending something to the moon. SpaceX has not put their Starship into orbit yet, and they need that Starship to also go to the moon. So, now, in my opinion, it looks like Blue Origin is ahead of the game. You know, and not only that, Blue Origin has a cargo version of this Blue Moon lander. Blue Moon crewed lander is big. I mean, it's, you know, three or four times bigger than the LEM of the moon, six different times. And so, you know, it's a very big lander. And the cargo version, about half that height, but capable of putting like 6,000 or 7,000 pounds of tools and material, you know, stuff onto the lunar surface. They'll be using that, you know, to, and especially in the future, bringing material to the lunar base. But that cargo version, the engine has not been fired yet in space. It's called the B-7. The B-7's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, and capable of producing around 10,000 or so pounds. Very decent on Apollo missions. Apollo liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they...
Nap time complete.
If that engine is good. And then they plan on doing that before the... So the actual lunar lander for people will have three of those engines. So, you know, instead of 10,000, you'll have over 30,000 pounds of possible thrust, which is a big difference from the actual LEM that you went up on the six successful missions that landed on the moon for Apollo. Anyway, looking at the time, so, you know, let me just stand by if anybody has any comments before we go back to Roy.
Paul, it's Brian. I just want to thank you and thank Roy for the great presentations. And, you know, we'll see what happens. Look forward to the next chapter in this. So, thank you.
Okay, Brian, thanks for being there, and we're looking forward to future missions. Wonder how many of the other astronauts will be hams. Someday we'll have them on the surface of the moon, you know, transmitting, looking for a pile up on, you know, from the moon. Anyway, thank you to... Had good holidays, Easter and all, and we'll be on tomorrow night, hopefully, with the club InfoNet, followed by Slop and Chop, and that's always followed by Radio Newsline. Anyway, you, Roy, AT2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. We'll be back next week, hopefully. So please join us as well. As always, I want to leave you with some words of wisdom from some wise men. Our own Dick K2IW, always used to end his technical nets with the advice of the